Last time we were focusing on the properties of a radio link, and so you're transmitting your signal via radio over a distance. This happens using an antenna, and basically the signal degrades, fades with distance and other factors. Okay, so the way in which the signal power decreases, we divide it up for effects of large scale and small scale fading. And large scale fading says that no matter what, the signal is going to drop in power with the distance proportional to the distance squared. Okay. Other shadowing events, so the impact of the terrain. And the atmosphere can cause that degradation to change somewhat from that. We looked at more complicated loss models. So again, if you have some terrain, you're in a city or a mountainous area, what can you say? So in the cities, you have a lot of empirical data, a lot of measurements, and a lot of curve fitting to those measurements. Okay. Typically, you get data from one or two or three cities, and then you try and generalize to a more general case for that. What we concluded from the large-scale fading direct discussion, we also looked at multipath effects. So if you have more than one signal because you're bouncing off the terrain, what happens? For a two-path system, power starts dropping, and then with the distance to the power 4 instead of 2. Okay. So the high-level conclusion we came to from large-scale fading, which we'll carry on to the second part of today's lecture, is that power is going to diminish somehow exponentially with distance. That exponent is going to be somewhere between 2 and, say, 5.5. Now, to make things more complicated, you have what's called small-scale fading effects, and these are caused by multipath by motion, and they can cause distortion to amplitude, phase, or frequency. And so these can happen sort of either slow versus fast is relative to the duration of a bit. So the effects may be similar over the duration of the bit, or they may be, if you have a fairly slow bit, if it's slow data link, you may actually see multiple changes over the duration of one bit. And typically, they impact different, these changes impact different frequencies differently, and so there's a question of how that impact, what that impact looks like relative to the bandwidth of the signal. So if it's flat, it means that within the bandwidth of the signal, everything's changing more or less the same. If it's frequency selective, then you get notches out of your spectrum within the signal. And so then you get distortion, possibly recover from the portions of the signal that are left. So, today, what we're going to do is first we're going to look at one more modulation technique, which is specific to, fairly specific to wireless comms. Versions of spread spectrum and optical comms, but that's not what we're worried about. This technique is the spread spectrum technique. And as the name implies, the idea is to take a narrow band signal, which can then be subject to severe flat fading, and spread it so that you'll get instead selective fading and hopefully again be able to recover from the portions of the signal that you have left. Okay, so now additionally we'll see that it's more resistant to things like jamming for some reason. Okay, and again, Stallings has a good discussion of this, and that's where most of the notes from today's, all of the notes from the spread spectrum lecture come from. Okay. And so, again, the idea is that your channel encoder is going to produce a relatively narrow band signal. And so it could be fairly susceptible to fading effects and fairly susceptible to jamming. What we want to do is spread the bandwidth of that signal. And so this gains some immunity to noise and multipath effects. So then it's frequency selective, and then it's going to take one particular frequency and spread it out over a greater frequency, you're sort of impacting less of a proportion of the signal. And also we'll see, depending on how you do that, clever enough about how you do that, you can, even though you're using this broader spectrum, you can allow multiple users to be operating within this broader spectrum at the same time. Okay. So what we said before, when we had the narrowband signal, that represents a channel, and you have one user at a time in there. Now, if you're clever about how you share things out, you can allow multiple users operating over the same spectrum. Okay, so we take our data and we modulate the encoder data, we modulate it, and we then spread it, and we'll take a look at a couple of different techniques for how we can spread our signal. We transmit it, and then we undo what we did before. In order to do that, you have to know how you've, it's sort of like modulation, you need to know how it is modulated, you need to know how it's spread, and typically there's some code involved in that, and which indicates the spreading sequence, and again, you have to use that same code on one sense at the other end. Okay. So we're going to look at two techniques, frequency hop spread spectrum and direct sequence spread spectrum. Okay, and the idea with frequency hop spread spectrum is that we change the frequency at which we're, base frequency at which we're transmitting our signal. The idea with direct sequence spread spectrum is essentially that we change the bit rate by, again, coding a single bit as a series of bits at a higher bit rate. So we'll take a look at these one at a time. So frequency hop spread spectrum changes the bandwidth by changing the base frequency of the signal at periodic intervals. So, we can think of a channel being divided into a number of carrier frequencies, which is going to form a number of subchannels. And then the spacing between these carrier channels is related to the bandwidth of your input signal. The transmitter is going to operate at one subchannel at a time, and the channel, the sequence of channels, is going to be determined by a spreading code. Okay. And so basically, what happens is if you took your original signal and you'd have some sort of modulation which would allow you two, four bits to be represented. And so, of course, in order to do that, so you want to just represent 0 1, you need two separate frequencies. Now, within the spectrum, the overall spectrum of the system, you can maybe fit a number of these narrowband signals in without interfering with each other, but just at different carrier frequencies. So, you have these different bands, and then within each band, you're representing your 0 or 1. And so, you know which band you're in, you know how to interpret your signal. So, what this means is that we modulate our signal, or as we would before, so we represent our bits using frequency shift keying. Then we change the carrier frequency at which it's transmitted. Okay, so we initially change the carrier to one frequency, and you shift that frequency. You do that according to some code or table. We'll see that that produces a frequency shifted signal, which you can filter to get the main lobe of that. You transmit that, and again at the other end, you combine with the same frequency and filter it, and you can, through that, recover your original signal. So we'll go through that now. So our original signal, SD, is in the form of sine wave, cosine wave, and you have to have a signal for each bit, or a frequency associated with each bit. So you have a base frequency of 0, and then the bits are represented as shifts up by the delta band. So we have our base frequency, we have a number of bits, and we have two bits, plus and minus one. We have the frequency separation, delta F, so that's related to the bandwidth it takes to send our signal. And then we have the T, the the moment of again this duration and then we combine our original signal with our spread spectrum signal, and again, this is also a sinusoid running at some frequency. And again, when we multiply these two cosines together, we see what we get is a half something with the sum of the two frequencies, is a half something with the difference between the two frequencies. Okay. And so we get shift by again, we get shift by FI in our of our base frequency. Now you only want to send one of these, so you want to send both. You're adding your frequencies, and so you filter out the second portion of the signal. Okay. And so again, what we're transmitting is something now running the frequency shifted up by FI. Again, at the receiver, we just unwind all of that. So we have a received signal, and we multiply that by our carrier frequency there, or our coded signal, so cosine 2 pi over 5 t. And again, if you look at the plus, you're either adding or subtracting that frequency. When you add it, you get shifted up by 2FI now, but when you subtract it, you get your original signal back. Okay, and so you filter for this portion of the signal, and you cover your original signal, sort of modulo of dropping power. So that's how the shifting is done. And naturally, it doesn't matter whether you're representing a bit, you know, a single bit or multiple bits, you can change the frequency in a similar way. Now, there's then a relationship between, the changes in the frequency hopping, or the changes in frequency, the shifting up and down of the frequency, can happen at a different rate than the data rate. So you can have multiple frequency changes per bit. So over the time of one bit, you can have several frequency hops, or a frequency hop can persist over several bits. If a frequency hop persists over one or more bits, you have what's called slow frequency hop spread spectrum. If you make multiple changes per bit, you have what's called the fast frequency hop spread spectrum. So, just to take an example to try and be clear about what the means. We have now our original modulation scheme where each signaling element is 2 bits. Okay, so within the original modulation, you have you're representing four different signaling elements representing the four combinations of 2 bits, so 0001, 1011. So you have, without the popping, you would have you pick up a certain proportion of the atmosphere. Now, within the entire spectrum of your channel, maybe you could fit in a certain number of these, of this, you need this much bandwidth to represent your signal, but maybe it's possible to shift where you're representing the signal to a number of different places. Yeah. And so we now have, and so in this example, we have four different possibilities for what region of the spectrum to have our signal in. So, in this case, we have a signal we're going to change every, we're changing our modulation every 2 bits. And what we see is that we're changing our hop sequence then every 2 signaling elements, or every 4 bits. So if we start out, our first hop sequence is 00, so that puts us down at our original spectrum where we would have been originally, and then we have 2 signaling elements, 00 at the bottom, and then 11 up at the top here. So we have the time of the bit, the time of the signaling out, the duration of the duration of bit, the duration of the signaling element, and then the duration of our pop. Okay. So each signaling element is 2 bits. Each pop
covers 2 signaling elements.
Okay. When we come to our next pair of bits, well, we now change our hop sequence, our hop code, and we say we should be up in this third region now. Okay. And so we move from bottom to the three up, and again within that you have either a 10 or a 11. After that, with the next sequence of bits, you now again change the hop code. So you're now up at the top, and then you have 0110. Change again down to 01, and then within which you get 01 and 11. And then back up to 11, where you get 10 and 00. Okay. So this is slow frequency, spreads hop spread spectrum, because your hop is only changing every few bits. And what we see is that we have spread the signal out from initially it would be in this region WD to covering this whole region WS now. So we've expanded the region by four, by a factor of four. Okay. So with fast frequency hop spread spectrum, the changes occur more rapidly than the change in signaling element. And so here again, we have our signaling element is covering two bits, four possible changes, which gives us our base region and four choices. But now, for each two bits, we're hopping twice. So for each signaling element, we have two hops. And so for the signaling elements, they're going to end up in two different regions. Okay. So for our first signaling element, we have 0, 0, which would put us down at 0. And again, code is 0, 0, and then in the corner here. Then our hop code changes to 1, 0, so the third region, and we'll end up in 0, 0 place, and then we'll end up in 0, 0 place for that. For our next two elements, we have 1, 1, which put us in the top of any region, and then our hop code is 1, 1, and then we drop down to 1, 0.
So each time. You change in that way.
And again, for any signal element, you're changing, you're hopping several times.
Okay. And the goal you have is to
represent a good increase in the spectrum that you're using. Because the more choices you have, the more resistance you get to jamming and noise and these frequency selective effects. Okay.
Just to take a look at the jamming issue.
If you think of your frequency shift keying transmitter, which is transmitting a bandwidth WD and a fixed power SJ on the carrier frequency. We think of, typically jammers also will be of fixed power. Therefore, the noise is going to be relative to the bandwidth of the overall bandwidth of the signal. Sorry. Now, if you use frequency hopping, then you have to jam over the whole spectrum. And so now, the power is going to be on any portion is going to be reduced by the number of separate possibilities you have. Okay, so this is the ratio of the
it's WD
to WS. Therefore, the improvement GA is WS over WD.
So, again, intuitively, all you're doing is you're spreading the power that used to be able to concentrate in one smaller region, WD, now has to be spread out over a larger region, WS. Okay, so that's one possibility for how you would spread the spectrum. So you are keeping your fairly narrow signaling, but you're moving it around a larger spectrum. Another possibility is what's called direct sequence spread spectrum. And in this case, what you're doing essentially is that for each bit you have, or possibly signaling element, we'll think of it as just being a single bit, you're encoding that bit according to some code, which means that each individual bit becomes a sequence of bits, encoded bits. What that does is it increases the bit rate, and there's an inverse relation between the bandwidth of a signal and its bit rate. So the faster the bit rate is, there's an inverse relation, between the duration of a signal of a bit and the bandwidth. So the faster, the more changes there are, the greater the bandwidth. So, this can be accomplished either by first encoding the bits and then modulating it, or modulating it and then multiplying the modulated sequence by your chipping sequence, so the code of bits that you're giving. In general, again, the original sequence is multiplied by this chipping sequence. Okay. And so, again, you see it doesn't. Here we take our original bits,
modulate them, and then we will modify the chipping sequence, and then work out that they do this together, and
combined with the chipping sequence and then modulated, you'd get the same output. So, again, this what this does is it forces the jamming signal to operate over a greater spectrum if it wants to jam the signal. Okay. So, our camera is again carrier frequency. We receive signals with the combination of the transmitted signal, jamming signal, and noise. When we spread that, the recovered signal, the jamming contribution, now is combined with chipping sequence, but this means that the power of the signal is spread out over the bandwidth of the chipping sequence. I guess it's started out concentrated at the carrier frequency, but not spread out. Okay. So again, you have a gain overall spectrum, which is 1 over TC relative to the narrow band spectrum, would be 1 over T. Okay, so again, there are benefits for an individual signal to be spread over this greater bandwidth. The issue with that, of course, is if you think of only a single signal using that bandwidth, then you've reduced the overall number of signals you can fit into any given amount of spectrum. However, because all of these signals are encoded, if we're clever about how we encode it, then we can have multiple signals operating in that same spectrum and yet be able to recover individual signals. And so let's think of having a number of users which are all sending transmitting with a certain data rate. For our example, we're going to use 1 is 1, minus 1 represents 0. Each of the individual users has their own unique chip code. Okay, so any bit sent by any user is then encoded into K bits. Okay, so each user is then going to be transmitting at a rate of K times their original rate B. And so what we're going to do is we're going to think of all the users sending these coded signals. And the question is, when any receiver is going to hear everybody's signal, is there any way they can pick out a single original transmission? And the answer to that, naturally, is yes, or would it be doing this
just for the purposes of thinking about what's going on, we'll think of the chip code as a vector of length k. And so each bit is going to be plus or minus this, can be represented either plus or minus this vector. We're going to be able to recover our original bit by, again, applying our code to the transmitted signal. If you think of a single signal, if you you have a bit one, so you have SJ, if you inner product SJ with SJ, what you're going to get is K, and then you see that we're going to conclude that we have a binary one, and if we inner product minus SJ with SJ, the minus K for binary zero. Okay, so for within a given signal, we see that it's here, you know, then you can easily recover, interpret which is zero, which is one. Now, what we want to do is make the code what we call orthogonal, so that the inner product of any two codes is zero. And if we do that, anytime we apply a code not privy, not relevant to the original signal, you're going to filter out that portion of the signal. So if user A transmits a bit, the code for user B is orthogonal to it, then anybody looking for user B's signal will zero out the portion from user A. So that's the ideal. We have complete orthogonality. Even if we don't, well, as long as we can get something that's more positive than not or less positive than not, then we might be able to recover our signal. So here, as in our example, we have three users, A, B, and C. They each have chipping codes, and we can see that CA is orthogonal to CB versus C, so you get 1, minus 1, 0, plus 1, minus 1, 0, minus 1, plus 1. Zero. So if you enter the inner product of A, C, A, and C, B, you get zero. If you take the inner product of C, B, and C, C, you get one, plus one is two, plus one is three, minus one is two, plus one is three, minus one is two. So they're not orthogonal. But, you know, again, perhaps the contribution that they make to each other is sufficiently small that you can still distinguish one from the other. So, again, if you have a sequence of bits to send, each user is going to apply their own chipping code to that. And so if it's a 1, you just get the code. If it's a 0, you get the code sent out. Okay. Now, clear enough that you can recover your own signal. The question is, what if we have want to recover our own signal. So A, again, it's transmitting a 1, it's going to transmit sequence 1, minus 1, minus 1, 1, minus 1, 1. It's transmitting 0, we get the reverse of minus 1, 1, 1, minus 1, minus 1, 1. And to recover either signal, again, you apply chipping code again. And if you do that for the first one, where the paper is in the product, we're getting 6, you do put something in the minus 6. So you can easily distinguish, sort of in the absence of other signals, so that we can easily distinguish between the two bits. If you got some other value besides 6 or minus 6, then there was either a transmission error or some sort of signal interference. Again, the likelihood is if you got 5 instead of 6, you'd still conclude it's a 1. If you get minus 5 instead of 6, you'd conclude it was a 0. So, again, if the signal is, if the codes are orthogonal, so A and B, so C, A and C, B are orthogonal to each other. So, if they're both transmitting bits, signals, then the combined signal that the receiver is going to see is going to see the combination of two, so A's encoded signal plus B's. Now, if the receiver is looking for A's signal, it will apply A's chipping code. And so, what that means is they're applying, they're taking part of the CA from CA, which is CA, or apply CA and CB together in order to lose whatever it has. So you will recover the original signal. Now, if the codes are not orthogonal, it's not quite that clean. So if we think about B and C sending data, so B is sending 1, C is sending 0. Then if they send their codes, what the receiver sees is the combination of the two. Now, if the receiver is looking for an individual signal, they're going to apply for B's, they'll apply B's chipping code, for C, they'll apply C's chipping code. What we see is if the signal, if you apply B's signal, you're going to get 4. So that 2 plus the negative from the C is taken off. But again, it's more likely, since it's above 0, it's more likely there's a 1 than a 0. So if there's only a small amount, still make the conclusion that that was a 1. Similarly, if you want C signal, you apply C's chipping code, you get minus 4. Since this is negative, we'll conclude that the 0 was sent. So even in the presence of interference from other signals, there's still a chance, depending on how much interference there is, there's still a chance of recovery. Your original signal. Okay. So, in general, what that means is how many users you can squeeze in depends on sort of how clever you can be with defining orthogonal
Okay. So, good spreading sequences, there's a number of factors which are considered to be desirable for good spreading sequences. The first of which is that they should be noise-like. So the mean of the bits should be approximately zero. So you should have approximately the same number of ones and zeros. And you should not have repeating patterns. Again, if you think about the issue of jamming, as soon as the enemy knows what the pattern of transmission is, they can again start to effectively jam it. Additionally, for efficiency and for sharing among multiple users, you want the codes to be orthogonal so that you can recover individual signals within multiple transmissions. And so there are a number of ways to generate these codes. We'll look at PN sequences, which are generated using hardware or in general ways. And have these sort of tendencies look fairly always like. Or just generate orthogonal codes. Again, then there's an issue of predictability. Okay. So our PN generators produce sequences which will eventually repeat, but prior to the period will appear to be random. We always need to start at some point, so we'll have a seed. So if you know what the seed was and you know the method of generation, it's completely predictable. But not knowing those two things, and so there's a number of properties that are nice for these to have. Having roughly the same number of zeros or ones, and even the number of zeros or ones in a row should be regulated. Okay. So you want most of the time you don't want it to be essentially anywhere at all, and then you should have a decreasing number of longer. You don't want predictability, and typically within shifting, you don't look at the same cycle shifted, and don't want correlation. Okay. One common way of generating these sequences is using linear feedback shift registers. Okay, so again, in hardware, they use a history of previous bits, and they combine those previous bits, that history, in various ways. And again, you got to be sort of clever about how you were combining them to make the thing work properly. Again, once the work's done, it's easy enough. It's easy to make that. So, your, given a history of N bits, you take a combination of some or all of those N bits to generate your next bit. Okay, so the A's are the coefficients of generator polynomials, and I was going to say whether you take that bit or not. So that bit or not. And then whichever ones you select to, you know, do that sort together. And again, you'll need, since you're taking history, you gotta start somewhere, so you'll have to initialize your initial value. You'll have to have initial values. Okay. So, LFSRs have a number of desirable properties. They are periodic with a maximum period of 2 to the n. So, if you think about it, if you run through all possible combinations of bits, then you're back to somewhere, something that you've seen before. So, the maximum period you can have is all possible combinations of bits. It's possible to find some way to generate, there is always an LFSR that will generate this maximum period. You can't use an initial state of oscillators. Okay, so to give an example, we have four bits, which will again generate three bits, which will generate the fourth bit. We have to start, so we start initially with 3 is 1, everything else is 0. The output is always be 0. And the new bit we generate, so 3, will be B0 excludes all of B1. Okay. So we start with that initial condition, then we shift our bits. So B3 becomes B2, B2 becomes B1, B1 becomes B0. Our output is B0, and B3 becomes the exclusive OR and B3 would be the exclusive OR of B1 and B0. Okay. Again, we shift, and then B3 is again the exclusive OR of B1 and B0 from the previous time. Shift again, B3 is the exclusive OR of B1 and B0 from the previous time. Shift again, and keep going. Okay, and so what we see here is that we get the keep going, we get the maximal period, which is 2 to the n minus 1, so 2 to the 4 minus 1, and when we finish, we're back where we started from. Okay, and so again, with this implementation, you get all of it. It can be shown that you have all these desirable properties for the sequence. You have roughly the same number of zeros and ones.
random. The runs have, again, a good distribution. And the shifts between the sequences are not highly correlated. Okay. Having said that, they're not great for providing codes that for CDMA systems. It's hard to generate sort of orthogonal codes. So there are ways of making more complicated combinations that have better orthogonality properties. The other possibility, the last possibility we consider, is to directly generate orthogonal codes. And again, this is useful in the CDMA system, where we're trying to distinguish one signal from another. Okay. One of the most common codes used for CDMA applications is what's called a Walsh code. And Walsh codes are generated recursively. And so you start out with your initial matrix of zero, and you build up bigger and bigger matrices by taking your original matrix and doing three copies plus one inverse copies. Okay. The properties it has that it's, if you look, you can use then the rows of this matrix as your codes, and each row is going to be orthogonal to any other row. Okay. There is cross correlation, so if you have code in a shifted version, then they are correlated. Therefore, you have to synchronize your systems to make sure that you're applying the code at the proper point. Okay. So, again, if you just look at the building out, start with our initial matrix of zero. We then apply that's a 1x1 matrix. So you have a 2x2, you have zeros, it's like 1x1. Then 4x4, and you have your W2 in here, and then the negative W2, and keep going. And again, if you take any random row, these two rows, 0, 0, 1.
Okay, so if you look at any two rows, they are orthogonal to each other. Okay. So that allows you to, again, generate these orthogonal codes. One other nice property they have is that if you look at variable length, stretching them out or compressing them, they'll still retain these orthogonality properties. And what that allows you to do is to run your system at different data rates. So if different senders are sending at different data rates, we'll assume that there's some minimum data rates, and then anything else is a power of 2, then what you can do is change the rate of your code
receive signal, it's a combination of your data plus your code. You can use the rate of the code to change the overall rate and allow everything to then run at a single, to be received at a single rate. And so the codes can be generated just by using Walsh matrices of different sizes. Okay, so again, the main idea of spread spectrum is to try to improve the quality of the signal you're receiving, either in the face of fading effects or in the face of deliberate jamming. The way you do that is by spreading the spectrum, so increasing the spectrum over which you transmit the system, the signal. We saw a number of ways to do that. And so, again, doing that improves the quality of the signal being received. The trade-off, of course, is that you're using more spectrum. So we can think of these clever techniques for allowing multiple users to use the spectrum at the same time. And a lot of, for a while, this sort of technique was fairly popular in cellular systems. What we'll see is that things have moved on again. And we'll see that later. Okay, so we'll take our break now. And when we come back, I'll introduce the topic of sort of cellular coverage of sort of how do you view, well, how do our overall, at a very high level, how are cellular networks arranged, and in particular, how do we arrange for sort of universal coverage? And so I'll introduce that. We'll save all the mathematics for next lecture. So we'll take our usual 15-minute break.